I'm Sarah, and I'm really excited to have with me today Cole Booty. Cole is a new faculty member here at Manchester, and I'm going to go ahead and let him introduce himself. So go ahead, Cole.
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks for having me on the podcast today. So like Sarah said, I'm a new assistant professor of pharmacy practice and specializing in acute care with a clinical practice site at Parkview Regional Medical Center, where I cover internal medicine type patients as well as progressive care.
And I asked Cole to be with us today because there were some new surviving sepsis guidelines that were just recently introduced. And I was hoping Cole could kind of give us a rundown of things that have changed and things that haven't changed and what that means for us. So just to kind of start, can you tell us what has changed, Cole?
Yeah, so the previous guidelines before the 2021 guidelines were last updated in 2016, so it's been about 5 years since those guidelines have been updated. If you look at all of the recommendations, there's probably about 20 changes that they made. Most of them are probably about just updating the strength of the recommendation or the quality of evidence. But there are a few significant changes that I want to mention today. The first one being QSOFA is now gone. So in terms of evaluating if someone meets sepsis criteria, they've gone away with using QSOFA. They still state that there isn't a great robust way to classify them. A lot of that, the reason for QSOFA being removed from their recommendation is that they find that it's not as sensitive as something like SIRS criteria. So they were finding that about a large majority of patients weren't meeting that QSOFA criteria. Additional recommendations, so the 30 mL per kilo over 3 hours fluid resuscitation recommendation had previously been a strong recommendation from the Society of Critical Care Medicine, but they downgraded that to a weak recommendation. There wasn't really too much of new studies came out. Some of the rationale behind it was to clinically evaluate the patient that is at bedside that you're looking at, as opposed to a strong recommendation being, this should be for everyone. So really individualizing that fluid resuscitation and how much fluid those patients are getting may be different for someone with a skin and soft tissue infection versus someone that might need a little bit more, like a necrotizing pancreatitis and severe septic shock might need some more. So really evaluating the patient clinically. I think one of the things that, for myself as someone who teaches fluids and electrolytes here at the College of Pharmacy, something that I know I taught my students this semester was the differences and which fluid should be used in that initial resuscitation. So with the 2021 guidelines, they now recommend using a balanced crystallary over something like normal saline. So our balanced crystalloids being lactated renards being probably the most prominent one used in clinical practice at the time. A lot of this has to do with two major trials that were released in 2018. So a couple of years after the previous guidelines had been released. The two trials were from the same author group out of Vanderbilt in Tennessee. They looked at normal saline versus lactated renards, and especially in the critically ill, critically ill patients, they found that lactated Raynaud's was beneficial in acute kidney, the composite of acute kidney injury from death, new renal replacements, or an increase in the same creatinine greater than 200% from baseline. So that's where that recommendation came from. I think that having been at a different institution recently, I think that's starting to catch on in clinical practice, utilizing that SMART trial and that SALT-ED trial to really start using more of that lactated renards in our sepsis patients. And now with the guidelines being updated about 2 months ago, we might start to see lactated renards being used more and more in clinical practice.
I was just going to say, I feel like lactated renards is making a like renaissance right now. Really, we're going from using a lot of saline and pretty much everything to, you know, using lactate a little bit more. So it does seem like that's kind of the way a lot of disease states are going.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of it has to do with normal saline being kind of abnormal, if you will. It's not very physiologic when you look at the components of it with the salt and chloride content compared to something like lactate ingredients.
So are there any guidelines or any other literature sources that practitioners are looking at that maybe conflict or contradict these current new guidelines?
So the Society of Critical Care Medicine is one of the societies that is currently sponsoring, or a lot of their authors reside within that society. The European Society of Intensive Care Medicine released essentially a copy of these guidelines, but those were co-authors on this guideline as well. So really now, those are the two main sepsis septic shock guidelines. One is just a little more appeasing to the eye, if you will, uses a little bit more color. So they were published in two different journals, but again, they were essentially the same article.
Well, that makes it a little bit easier. You don't have to try to weigh different pieces. So is there anything else that our listeners should know from this update?
I think one other thing that this guideline had recommended is really trying to evaluate the risk factor that patients have for different different infections that they might have. So in the previous guidelines, it said to use broad spectrum antimicrobials, didn't really delineate out which type of infection the patient could have. Now they specify different criteria for using anti-MRSA antimicrobials, as well as antifungals. And I think they do a pretty good job of laying out the different risk factors and the guidelines that patients could have that would meet some of those criteria for those individual antimicrobials.
So do you think that this is going to lead to a decrease? And I know vancomycin use is just really big in this area. Do you think this is going to lead to a decrease in that use?
I think so. I hope so. I think like really evaluating if someone has a risk factor for MRSA is going to be beneficial. If we start to see providers and clinicians really starting to like, does this patient have risk factors for MRSA or do they not? Do I need to add on vancomycin? I think as these guidelines kind of stew and resonate with clinicians, that we'll hopefully start to see. And I think that was kind of the hope of the authors. I don't want to speak for them, but in their rationale, they mentioned ways to potentially de-escalate quicker and really providing those risk factors kind of help elucidate whether someone does have those risk factors in those antibiotics.
I'm sure their kidneys will think this too.
Yes, I'm sure they will.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Cole. I really appreciate you bringing this information to our audience.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Preceptor Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We're interested in hearing from you and content that you think would make our podcast better. We look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks, everybody. Bye.